Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to another exciting and informative edition of Atlanta Business Radio. I'm your host, Stone Payton, but this is actually a special edition that we enjoy doing every month or so with the Georgia Society of CPAs, and we have our good friends and marvelous co-host here today, Mr. John Masters and Joel Pascanner. How you guys doing?
Doing good. Thanks
Very
for having
good.
Us.
Well, it is so good to have you guys back in the studio. It's always a lot of fun. Get us caught up, if you would, before we jump in and visit with our guests. What's going on over there at the Society? I understand you've got quite the shindig coming up pretty soon.
Things are, as usual, rocking and rolling over at the Georgia Society. You could only imagine. I don't know if we went into this last time, but we have a new location. We're located in the Perimeter Center area, have beautiful new facilities, state-of-the-art. And as always, we greatly appreciate the opportunity we've had here to appear every couple of months and discuss a topical subject relating to taxation. John and I are, as you know, members of the leadership team of the tax section of the Georgia Society of CPAs. And we also appreciate this from a personal standpoint. And in the past, we've had, John and I have had a couple of guests, and it's worked out very well. And we are fortunate enough and really lucky to have a guest today. We have the commissioner of the Georgia Department of Revenue, Doug McGinnity, and he's agreed to appear and discuss various issues relating to the department. So I think we're all excited. Looking forward to have some fun.
He says he's not going to the party this weekend. I don't understand that.
There is a party, I think, that we didn't mention. The Georgia Society of CPAs does have their leadership council meeting. There are, I think, two a year, and it's Sunday and Monday.
So what do you guys do when you get together for something like that?
There's an agenda. The leadership, that group is about 150 people, actually, and that's the management of the Georgia Society of CPAs. And so they elect people to nominate people to different things for the convention that'll come up in June, and then the new officers are selected.
And aren't you going to get, like, some kind of radio host award or something, or do you need me to wang-dangle something between now and tomorrow?
Well,
you should get something, a microphone.
They promised they'd give us breakfast.
Breakfast. What is the radio award? I know you have the Oscars, the Emmys, the Tonys. What is the radio award?
I don't know, but I'm going to work on this. While you do your
Marconi's,
interview, I'm going to do some internet research and come up with something for you.
Because we would like to be nominated.
Yes.
I think you should
We're
be.
We're anticipating a nomination.
Well, I've been looking forward to this segment. When I saw it on the program, I knew this was going to be an informative and fun session. You know, just yesterday, we had a gentleman from the Georgia Department of Revenue. We had the CIO, Michael Long, with us. Jay Farrow, who is the CIO of American Cancer Society, hosted that segment. And so when I saw that Doug McGinnity was coming on, I thought that'd be a great chance to we could spend some time talking about Michael Long's golf game.
I'm shocked he has time to play golf. That's news to me.
Well, what I learned yesterday, and he did a marvelous job. He's a very entertaining, very bright guy, and they did talk about a lot of serious stuff. But he's also just a good guy, fun guy to be around. But he, Michael Long, was a professional football player. We would say soccer. And you know, I didn't engage the entire time. I caught up on Words with Friends and some other things while they were talking. But what I did pick up, I think the older he gets, the better he was. Is that,
I think that's true for all of us. I think
we all like to think that anyway.
You know what I was going to point out, none of this is on topic, but Doug McGinnity.
Well, it depends on who you are. For me, it's right on top.
All right, because Doug McGinnity was the Ivy League Soccer Player of the Year.
Oh,
since
really?
We're discussing this.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you want to go into this at all before we
it's your
get
show.
Into something
I've done
serious.
That.
But
I got to play Angry Birds.
Okay.
I queued everything up.
Okay.
That was a long time ago. Long time ago.
Okay. But anyway, what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn it over to you, Doug, and you can and we'll sort of intersperse ourselves with questions and discussion, and you can take it away.
Well, first I'd like to thank you all for having me here today. It's a real pleasure. And worth mentioning at the beginning that the department has worked hard to develop a good relationship with the Georgia Society of CPAs over the last several years. We are obviously a big agency that collects a lot of money for the state, but the CPAs in the state spend as much time as anybody working with the department, and that relationship has been a real positive, I think, for both the citizens of the state of Georgia and for the department over the last several years. And I'd like to thank you all for helping make that the case.
Well, we appreciate that. It's been good to work with the Department of Revenue, too. Things are actually, in my view, from sitting on the outside looking in, improved a lot in the years that you've been there as commissioner.
Well, I appreciate that. Most people, try to avoid working with us as much as possible, which I understand. And part of my view, and I'm coming up on my fourth year at the department. I started when Governor Deal was first elected, so it would be 4 years in January. But part of the what he wanted to make sure happened, and certainly that I did as well, is to make life as painless as possible for taxpayers here in Georgia who are trying to do the right thing. Let them pay the taxes they owe. Nobody likes paying their taxes, but to let them pay it and then get on with their lives and do other either productive or unproductive things, whatever they want to do, but not have to hassle with us. And so we've certainly tried to work on that over the last several years. But if it makes sense, why don't I step back and give a little bit of the big picture about what the Department of Revenue does and how That'd we interact with the citizens across the state, and just so people know. And honestly, I didn't have a full understanding of what the department did when I first started 4 years ago, because we do have a pretty big operation and a pretty big reach across the state. But the state itself is a huge enterprise. It spends $40 billion a year or so. About half of that is collected in taxes every year, and we're obviously the department that collects most of those taxes. The other money comes either from transfers from the federal government or from other fees or tuition that the state collects. Other agencies collect, like, you know, universities collect a lot of tuition, and some other agencies collect some fees. But half the revenue that's spent every year is collected by the Department of Revenue. So we do three really main things as a department, as an agency of the state. The first is obviously to collect that $20 billion or so of tax revenue every year. But then we do two other things that are much less well known. One is we are the agency that regulates alcohol and tobacco in the state of Georgia. So we're kind of the local equivalent of ATF without the firearms in Georgia. And once upon a time, those folks, and these are folks who carry a badge and carry a gun, they're armed and police personnel. Well, we spent a lot of time busting up stills and collecting or chasing moonshiners who were making stuff and selling it around the state.
You're still doing that? Or?
After NASCAR, we're still going to...
much less. As everybody knows, Georgia has become a much wetter state. Once upon a time, a lot of the state was dry, and if you wanted to consume or alcohol, you had to do it illegally. Now it's much wetter states, and it's just as easy to drive down to the local store and buy it there than to have to hassle with... some unregulated product that might be out there. So I think there's still plenty of people who make it, but now it's really for home consumption or to give your friends. There's not much of a business left, but we still every once in a while come across somebody who is trying to make a living doing it illegally.
How much of your time, I hear you, so in other words, under your purview of these other things, which I really didn't even realize, how much of your time do you devote to, other than income tax, tobacco, firearms, motor vehicle, is it a lot of your time?
So it depends. I think over the course of a year, the vast majority is around taxes and tax administration. Motor vehicle is the third piece in which you just touched on. Right. So taxation, alcohol and tobacco, and then motor vehicle is the third. So the Department of Revenue is really the repository for everything about your vehicle. We don't do driver's license. That's a different agency. But your tag, your license plate, your title, your insurance, your registration, all that information is kept in big databases at the Department of Revenue. The work itself, when you go get a new tag or new title or you have to renew your registration, that's done at the county level. So everybody knows they go into the county desk or you send in your paperwork. But we are really keep the Intel or the IT backbone for that entire system at the Department of Revenue, and then taxes obviously the biggest piece. But it's a diverse, wide-flung operation. We got offices all over the state, to give you another idea of how I look at it, we have about 1,100, 1,200 employees that work at the department. Our budget every year is about $150, $160 million spend of taxpayer money to do all those three things, to collect the $20 billion, to have the alcohol and tobacco enforcement, and then also to run the motor vehicle division as well.
What's the biggest problem that you have is administering the tax system?
That's a good question. I would say what I've really tried to work on over the last 4 years is increasing our efficiencies and making us much more what I would call customer focused. It's a little bit of a misnomer, right? We're not in a true business, but taxpayer focused, right? People don't really have a choice but to deal with us. In a real business, people always have a choice. You can fire your local merchant and go down and hire the next one. But to be much more customer service focused. When I started, we had some pretty significant backlogs at the department and a pretty tough time just answering the phone. You can imagine people call us for lots of reasons. They want to know where their refund is. They have a tax issue. And we really were struggling with just doing some of the basic stuff. And so we spent a lot of time in the last 4 years focused on both of those. And I think the that's a long way of answering your question, but the biggest challenge.
Well, I don't know if it really is though. You're looking at some of the information you've got. The call volume is actually up, but your backlog and all of the problems and a lot of the things that I used to see are down. So I was curious in looking at some of the data. Well, why is the call volume actually trending up? I guess it's more people and so on, but it must be a different kind of call than a lot of what you used to get.
Yeah, and we do track all that. So, you know, this is a business radio show, I think that the thing that's been interesting to me, my background is from the private sector. I help run and build a couple insurance brokerage companies. And what I've tried to do is bring some of what I think I learned in the private sector to the Department of Revenue. So anybody who runs a business out there knows that if you're not measuring something about your business, it's almost impossible to manage it.
Right.
If you don't know how long it takes to sell something to a customer or what your cost of sales is to that customer or any of the other metrics that a normal business does, the chance of you fixing it or making it better, almost zero. So one of the things we started doing was really measuring the activity. We really try to figure out what our backlogs were and what categories are there, how many calls are coming in and why are they coming in. And then once you have that information, you can start doing something with it. So I've really taken the kitchen sink approach. We've thrown everything at it. We changed out it is what it is. We change out some of the management. We've reallocated some resources. You look at the list, okay, why are people calling, or what are the work items that are in our inventory, and why is it taking so long to get to them? And you figure out what can we do differently to get rid of some of those. So people call us all the time, want to know where their refund is, right? They file their sure. tax return right. in January or February. Oh, yeah. They're due a refund. They may file on a Tuesday. Wednesday, they might give us to Thursday or Friday. They start calling. Where's my refund? Where's my refund?
Absolutely, sure.
Yeah, what's wrong with
And we laugh, but, you know, people want their money back. Right. And I get it, right? And people are entitled to get their money back. We've done a couple things. One, we've tried to speed up our processing and get stuff out the door. So now if your refund's clean and there's no issues with it, we can often get it out the door in 48 hours. So that's going to knock down some of those calls. Not everybody calls within 2 days.
Right, right.
But people do start calling within a week. So if we can get it out, we knock down some of those calls.
Now, is refunds a large percentage? Like, is it 20% of the returns are refunds, a half, or is it a bunch?
I think, a great question. Individuals file about 4 million returns with us every year, and we issue about 3 million refunds out of those 4 million returns.
Wow.
Totaling over a couple $1 billion every year.
Now, is that smart, guys, or should they be working with people like you so they're not having to send in too much and get it refunded, or is that a good way to do it as any and have your nice little present?
Well, it depends on your situation. You really don't want to owe too much or get too much of a refund. But some people actually use that as a savings mechanism. They'll over withhold so they get a check back. I mean, it's better than not having any kind of saving program.
It is, and without getting off topic again, that's sort of like a double-edged sword question we get all the time. And sometimes with us, it's like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Get a huge refund, you get the client who's screaming at you, why'd you do this? Certainly if you owe money and you got penalties, you get the same thing. You get it from both sides. And then there are many taxpayers who use it as forced savings. And also psychologically, I even remember myself as a, you know, figuring I'm going to get a refund psychologically.
Yeah, I feel a lot better getting a refund than I do.
But meanwhile, you're taxing his system. I mean, that's. I mean, you would prefer that they got it a lot closer to even, wouldn't you? Or?
Yeah, you know, for us, it almost doesn't matter. You know, and you got to visit with our CIO yesterday. At its core, we're just a huge data processor, right? We bring in $20 billion a year. There's 4.5 million tax filers every year, 4 million individuals and 500,000 businesses. You know, they send in what amounts to a check in a form that goes with it. Well, we take the money, we deposit it, and then overnight it gets sent to the state treasury. So we don't keep any of the money for any period of time. But the information that came with that check, the tax form, is information we have to keep in huge databases. So we're just a huge data processor. So at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter whether the check we send out has $1,000 on it or $10,000 on it. No one's handwriting the check. A computer's generating the check. It's all done automatically. So at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter that much to us. But, you know, it is an issue for taxpayers. And the one place it does have an impact on the state is big corporate filers who file and then get interest on it, or we either owe interest to us or we owe interest to them. It can turn into real dollars from the state's perspective pretty quickly.
Do you have any kind of a control or a block if somebody, and I've had some taxpayers, we do some high net worth people who have a refund of in the millions of dollars. Does that hold up the processing, or is it regardless of, like you said, $10 or $10
million? So it's a great question, and I'll tell you a little anecdote that illustrates the point. We can process everything. And if you use a sort of an image of a conveyor belt, a return comes in and it goes down the conveyor belt, and we check that return for all sorts of things. Do they add it correctly? Do they subtract correctly? You know, did they take the right credits or the right deductions? And if there's a problem with it, we kick that return out and somebody has to manually take a look at it. So about 2 months ago, I don't know if you saw the news story or not, but we got three returns that were filed with us that were each seeking a $95 million refund. They were fraudulent returns. It was made up information, but they printed a $95 million refund on it. Well, our system is set up that return went down the conveyor belt. And yes, there are sort of filters put in place that say, hey, if there's a refund that's more than X, and you know, we don't disclose what X is, but if it doesn't look right, we kick that out and somebody takes a look at it. Well, we don't just process a $95 million refund without taking a look at it. I wouldn't be here doing this interview. Right.
Yeah, we're glad.
We laugh, but again, I'll take it back to we have 1,100, 1,200 employees. People don't look at every return that comes through. It's not physically possible. The computers have to look at it, and then we have to set up the rules for the computer to process those. So that one was kicked out, and we thought, well, this is ridiculous. You know, who thought we were going to send a $95 million check out? But we also thought, you know, maybe we can, you know, find out who thinks this is funny. And, I mean, it's a crime, right?
These are three of these you're saying.
There are three of them.
That's amazing.
So we sent a letter to the taxpayer and said, hey, you need to call us. We have a question about your refund. They called us, which we were stunned. We said, okay, just want to make sure we had the right all the information before we sent this check. We'll send it to you. And then we set up what amounts to a little bit of a sting operation to arrest these folks. The day of the supposed deposit, they had asked for an ACH, an electronic transfer to their bank account. We called them and said, hey, we had the bank call and said, hey, we can't do this without you coming down to sign for it. It's too big a check. Sure enough, they showed up. And so we arrested them at a Fifth Third Bank over at a Kroger and over in Smyrna. We made sure it was all our people around and arrested them for tax fraud. Because if we hadn't had the stops in place on that return, $95 million, not of my money, but of your tax money would have gone out the door.
No, you're right. So it has to be.
It has to be.
It has to be.
Well, you bring up an interesting point with identity theft issue. I'm sure you're having trouble with some of that. How has that grown, and what kind of problem is that for you today?
It's a significant issue. It's a significant issue at the state level. It's a huge issue at the federal level. We actually run two programs here in the state, and we've done as much or more than every other state, including the federal government. The department's gotten some notoriety or positive notoriety about it. I've been on CNBC and a bunch of other Wall Street Journal, a bunch of other places for what we do. But we run two programs. One is we put some pretty simple rules in place, the filters I was talking about, to check refunds as they come through. Some easy stuff that I'm happy to talk about, like if too many refunds are going to the same bank account or the same address, that's a red flag. And right. So we start looking at them, obvious stuff. The more sophisticated rules are in place too. But then we also run a program around identity theft, which is a huge issue. In fact, another anecdote, it happened to my wife. So the first year I was on the job, someone got a hold of her name, her social security number. They filed the return, made up some W-2 information. And we have, we don't have tons and tons of information about individuals. It's hard for us, a computer looking at a return, to say, is this the right person or is that the wrong person? And we don't always have the exact W-2 information, or we didn't in the past. We've worked to correct that. And so we processed that refund for my wife.
Was it just, I'm just interrupting, was it a joint return or just her?
Just an individual return.
And in the past she had filed jointly,
jointly. Right? Okay.
I've had a similar thing, but go ahead.
Yeah, it happens all the time.
It happens, yeah.
And if you had an individual looking at the return and checking it all out, they might have said, but we don't have the bandwidth to do that for every return, right, when you get four million returns coming in. So it was processed, the refund went out the door, and when my wife and I filed jointly, it got kicked out because someone had already used her name and social security number.
Ouch.
Which is, of course, ironic. Everybody finds that
right.
Particularly funny.
And the refund was for $95 million?
No. My wife wouldn't still be with me. So it's a big problem. So we now run another program that tries to look at every return that's going through, every refund that's requested, and to see if there's some indication about identity theft. So in that case, they had the name right, the social right, but it was a different address, different bank account, and a new employer that she had not worked at before. And so that return probably would have been kicked out and said, hey, that doesn't look right. We need to do some further checking on that. So in the last, I have some numbers here. In the last several years, those programs have been very effective. I think at the high water mark a couple years ago, we stopped 160,000 returns, totaling about $115 million. Of what we are pretty sure were all fraudulent ID theft returns. You can imagine if that's happening at the state of Georgia level, what's happening at the federal government level. The dollars are just so much larger. And we know we're not stopping everything. And that's what we stopped. And there's still stuff that gets through despite our best efforts. Now, those numbers have come down over the last couple of years, we think in part because of what we've been doing. But it's a big enterprise. All you need is a computer. You can buy the files with people's names and social security numbers, or you get them somewhere else. You just file electronically. If you file 1,000 returns and 500 get through, well, you've just made a pile of money, and you're not in any danger. You're not going to get shot at. You're not selling drugs on the corner. It's a big, big, big problem.
Would this scenario that you describe, if it had happened now, would the new, as this thing evolves, would your wife's return, would that have been caught up front?
I think it would have been now, because we've done two things. One is we run this ID theft or the ID theft program, and would have shown, hey, that's the right name, that's the right social, but we don't have any record of my wife's being at this address. In fact, we have her at these other addresses, so it probably would have been kicked out for that. We've also started grabbing other information that allows us to check W-2 information that in the past we have not been able to do. No taxing authority has been able to do. And so I think for two reasons, one, the address, and two, we would have looked at that W-2 and said, that doesn't look right. We're going to kick that out for that reason as well.
Since you have a good bit of this that's still happening, though, what happens to the actual bona fide taxpayer? If you pick up one that has that's got an issue, you think, what's the interaction with the taxpayer?
So if there's no doubt we create, there's sort of two ways it happens. There's no doubt we create some false positives in our programs, right? We stop a refund that is really due to the proper taxpayer. They've moved, they've gotten divorced, there's a life change, so they look different, but in fact, they really are who they are. Generally, we'll stop that return. We'll send a letter or an email to the taxpayer and say, hey, you need to get with us. Either get online and do one of those online quizzes like you see if your credit card has a problem or your checking account has had a problem. They can answer some questions that only they would really know about themselves. Then it automatically goes back in line and out the refund goes. So it adds a little bit of pain to the process, but not too bad. And we're always trying to balance those two, but not a long period of time.
Part of the reason I ask is because when it happens with the IRS, then your tax refund and so on, your account and all is messed up. In a lot of ways, it makes it difficult to do things.
Yeah. Oh, it does. And listen, I have firsthand experience with my wife. So the other problem, though, is when somebody does get a fraudulent refund through, in my wife's case, when we filed, it got kicked out. So we had to file paperwork with both the state and with the IRS. Mm-hmm. I think it takes a little bit of time, but we unwind those transactions, relatively quickly. I think the IRS, we took, I want to say it was 9 months, a year, or maybe it was a year to 18 months before it got fixed with the IRS.
Sure. Right.
We got our refund back, and we were fortunate. We weren't dependent on that refund, but folks do depend on their refunds, and it can be a real problem. It is a real problem.
Yeah, it's a hassle for the taxpayer when they get caught up for any reason. If they've been blocked, I've had several that have had something come up, and you can't even figure out what exactly happened. And these are all IRS issues. I haven't had one. I haven't had a problem with Georgia. Have you had any problem with Georgia?
I've seen more and more, and I have seen one. It's very similar to the one that the commissioner was describing. A little more bizarre, but it was a woman, married woman. Turns out Georgia had a return on file for her. She had become the primary Social Security number, and they had a joint return for her and another man. I remember talking to the person. They said it was bizarre because they said, yeah, we have a return on file already because we hadn't filed a return. We had extended it for Sue Smith, and it's a joint return with her and Marvin Jones. And I don't even know who that was.
That's a client of mine.
Okay, well, now I know. Okay.
Now it's coming into focus.
Well, because I actually asked her if she knew Marvin Jones, and I'll relay that to her. But but they had a joint return. And then what's interesting, that went through like yours, but they were able to, which was kind of funny. I said, do you have any record of, because usually you attach part of the federal return. So this person was actually very helpful at Georgia Department. She says, yeah, I see the federal return. Same thing, but they had a huge refund for Georgia, but they actually had a small balance due for the IRS, if you
really?
Can believe that. She says,
that's interesting.
I said, it sounds like identity fraud. I said, but it's so bizarre. And the woman said to me, yeah, typically you're not showing balances due on identity
right.
fraud.
Right, when they're trying to steal money.
Yeah, right, so. Right.
But yeah, it's a little bit, it's one of those classic, we do our thing, the criminals adjust, they start doing their thing, and so it's a never-ending game. But what has really driven this is electronic commerce. Right. Before, if you wanted to engage in this activity, somehow you have to get people's names and socials, which probably was possible. But then by hand, you'd have to fill out a form. A check would go to a physical address. And if too many checks started showing up at the same place, it's a little easy to catch somebody. Now, everything's done electronically. You file your taxes electronically. You just get online and use one of the tax services, Quicken or whatever. And then the refund comes electronically. And so people move them to the debit cards or to a bank account, and then that money's gone as quick as it hits their account. So the electronic commerce is great, but it has its downsides as well.
Is there any recommendations you have for taxpayers to help avoid being caught up in that?
So the standard recommendation is don't give anybody your Social Security number. The reality is it's a lot of people
out there.
They're out there, if you can file early, that helps a little bit because you've already filed, then somebody can't use your
That's a good point.
Their return will get bounced out.
It'll get bounced. Yeah,
a lot of people can't do that, or it's hard to do, and they need to wait.
Yeah, so there's the legislature to pass their conformity law earlier.
That would help.
That would help.
That would help too.
Well, you can do a whole show on that. That'd probably drive a lot.
We have.
We might.
No wonder you're struggling for ratings. No.
So I was thumbing through some of these graphics here as I'm listening to this conversation, and I see, like you mentioned earlier, call volume way up, but the the customer service wait times drop like a rock, which is a great thing. Wait times are way down. Backlogs are way down. What's the secret sauce to all that?
Great management.
No. Superior leadership.
You know, actually, I want to amen that, because that's actually true. It's been a lot of good things that's happened,
and impacts practitioners like you and your clients. Yes. Right? It's just not.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the Department of Revenue. I mean, to second John. I mean, the commissioner has done a great job, and John goes way back. Way, way back.
Thanks, Joel.
But I mean that as a compliment.
I rode my dinosaur here this morning.
I meant that as a positive. And I'm from New York, but I've been here about 20 years, and I go back a few commissioners. But I will say, in general, in terms of responsiveness, receptiveness, attention to constructive criticism and any sort of comments, this particular group and administration has really, really been excellent. And it's worked, as I think, better now than ever before.
Well, and I think I appreciate all that, but I think it's been a combination of a number of things. One is there is new management at the department, and you met one of them yesterday, the CIO, Mike Long. He's part of a team, some of which were there before, but some of which have come from the outside. I was lucky enough to recruit him from private industry, and he's brought a skill set that has been really helpful to the department in terms of delivering on time and on budget. We spent a lot of taxpayer money, and this was started before I got there, on upgrading our IT systems. Again, at our core, we're a huge data processor. So we now have systems that allow us to measure how much work we have in the department, how many calls we have coming in, what all we have sitting out there, so that, again, if you don't know what's there, it's hard to manage it. And when I first started, I would go speak to groups of CPAs and various other folks. And the biggest complaint I heard, I heard a lot of complaints, but the biggest complaint I heard is we're kind of a black hole, right? Someone would call us or send us a letter, and we'd never hear back. And all that does is generate more and more work, right? Because if you're a business owner and you've hired a CPA and you get a letter from the Department of Revenue that says X, Y, or Z, what are you going to do? You're going to give it to your CPA and say, hey, can you help me fix this? Well, if the CPA makes a call, sends us a letter, and can't fix it, what is the CPA going to do? He's going to keep making calls and keep sending letters until they fix it, because if I'm the business owner, I'm going to say, well, what am I paying you for if you can't fix anything with the department? Well, all that does is generate more and more work. It's more calls. It's more letters. It's more stuff for us to respond to. So once you know what you have, then we've reallocated some resources. We really do have a great management team there now. And so it's been just a combination of all of that, and it's helped over time, and hopefully that will continue as we go forward.
As we look at those kind of things, how has the new Georgia Tax Tribunal played into that? Has that been a help or a hindrance to the Department of Revenue? Well, you probably can't answer that question.
Well, no, I think it's been both. So just for the viewers to understand, historically, if somebody didn't like a decision of the department, and we have a lot of authority to kind of make a final decision on your tax bill, you had a choice. You could either go to Superior Court in your county, or you could go to an administrative judge that works for the state. Neither one was a great option in many people's view, because the Superior Court judges are hearing cases like rape, murder, drug dealers, all the criminal cases. They got real dockets, and tax may or may not be either one their interest or two their specialty. And then the administrative law judge had its own issues as well. So 2 years ago, we're just coming up on 2 years now, the legislature set up a new outlet, what's called the Georgia Tax Tribunal,
right,
which is an administrative law judge, but it's staffed by somebody who is a tax lawyer, or was a tax lawyer, somebody who really understands tax. And if you don't like what we've done, the department has done, at the end of the day, you have the right to go to the Georgia Tax Tribunal. And it's really attracted two types of cases. One are very big, complex tax disputes, and that's probably where they belong, because somebody right. needs to rule on these things. We may be right, the taxpayer may be right, but it's big dollars at stake. But the other is for smaller, mostly individuals who, for whatever reason, feel like they've not gotten the right resolution at the department. And a fairly decent volume of those cases have gone to the tax tribunal. There's own special rules. It's a little bit like traffic court, where you right. don't have to show up with the lawyer, and right. it's pretty tax or cost efficient. And I think it's both been good and bad. One, it's added some work to us at the department, just because of the volume of stuff. But it's also, on the good side, has helped sort of keep us more honest, right? We know somebody else is going to be looking at that case, it gives us some incentive to go ahead and resolve it. There's no point in it going down to the tribunal and then getting it worked out there if we can work it out beforehand. And so I think it's been a combination of both good and bad. And I think it's, but I think generally it's good for taxpayers here in the state to know that there's an outlet, and it keeps the power of the department in check. I mean, the Department of Revenue has a lot of power, a lot of authority, and if we misuse it, there ought to be a way for people to take a look at it.
Well, we're real happy, and I'm glad to say that we worked a lot on trying to get that established, and we're happy that it's working out well for the Department of Revenue. But our interest was basically to help taxpayers. That's why we were interested in it. So that's good.
Yeah, I'm curious as to y'all's view as to what's worked and what's not worked on that. But I'm glad to hear. It sounds like it's been a productive additive thing for the state.
Well, I believe from the activity that's gone on, it's been better than I would actually have hoped for. Part of that is due to the fact that they got an outstanding man for the job of judge, Judge Charles Boudreaux, and he's done a great job there with that, and it's a good addition. So I'm real happy about that. We could probably make a show on the tax tribunal too. It also probably wouldn't help ratings any.
How about, do you have any feel on this relatively new title ad valorem tax? Obviously that particular area generates revenue. In terms of the revenue it's generating versus the old method, is it revenue neutral? You know, obviously, I'm just throwing this out, and you know that there's a tax deduction issue that taxpayers are not happy with. But in terms of revenue, how is that worked out, and how does it rate compared to the old method?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think if you took a look at the numbers, it's probably been a net increase in tax revenue to the state in the early days. And you know, just to back up the sort of the big picture. Before, when you bought a car, if you bought it from a dealer, you would pay sales tax on that transaction. So the 7%, say 6, 7, 8%, depending on where you live, you pay sales tax on that transaction. Well, and then every year thereafter, everybody's familiar with the birthday tax, right? You get your ad valorem bill from your county, and you pay whatever the bill was every year to get your new little registration sticker, and that was how your automobile was taxed. Well, starting, I guess it's a year and a half ago now, it's the spring of whatever that was, 14? No, 13.
13, I think.
13, spring of 13. Yeah. That system changed. So the birthday tax went away for new cars. I won't even bother with talking about old cars. That system stayed in place for old cars. But for new cars, instead of paying that sales tax, you would pay what amounts to a sales tax. It's called the TAVT tax. It's still about 6.5%, 7%. And it didn't matter where you bought it from. Whether you bought it from your neighbor or from a dealer, you'd pay that. So every time a title is transferred, with a few exceptions, you now pay that tax. But then the birthday tax is gone after that. Well, I think it's been a net addition of revenue because it's picked up a bunch of transactions that weren't taxed before. When I sold my car to my neighbor before, I didn't pay sales, or he didn't pay sales tax on it. But now when that title transfers, they do. Even though the birthday tax has gone away. So I think it's been a net add of revenue so far. Now, that could change. It depends on how long people hold their cars and where they're buying their cars from. From an individual perspective, again, it could be a good thing or bad thing, depending on how often you buy cars, where you buy them from, and how long you hold them, and what you do with it at the end of the day. So, you know, most people, we haven't heard a lot of complaints about it. At the department, our biggest challenge was building taking our computer system that keeps track of all of these transactions,
right,
and updating it. That's part of our motor vehicle division, and that's an old, clunky mainframe system. And so our biggest challenge was just the administrative side of it. Whether it's a good idea or not, didn't really matter. We needed to make sure when somebody went into the county office, they could make that transaction, pay the right amount, get with their tag or their title, whatever they needed, and get on with their lives. And so far, from our perspective, that's worked pretty well. There's not been a lot of pain associated just with the transactions themselves.
So, somewhere I'd seen that there was some initiative to audit some of those or see how the transactions are going. I don't know if that was in something you had said somewhere or something I picked up elsewhere.
Yeah, anytime you have a new tax, there's going to be issues with how people are enforcing it. And so we will certainly take a look at and try to make sure that people are doing the right thing. Dealers and other individuals are doing the right thing and paying the right amounts. And that is something we have and will continue to look at.
Well, from my position outside looking in, I can say there's still a lot of confusion over what's going on with that law and how it actually works, especially with respect to trade-ins and that kind of thing. I don't think the public really has a comprehensive feel for that or understanding of that.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. It's not, I mean, even in my very brief description, I've left out caveats of this and that, whatnot. So it's not the most straightforward thing. Yeah. People kind of know they don't have to pay their birthday tax anymore on new cars, and right. then they pay whatever bill their total pay at the beginning. But it's not the simplest tax that we administer.
One of the things that I wanted to ask about was when you look at the problems that you have with administering the income tax part of it, which is probably what Joel and I are most familiar with, what is the biggest thing? I see you have a lot of problems with credits. Is that where most of the issues come up or a lot of issues come up?
So, to give some perspective of the roughly $18, $19 billion a year we collect in state revenue through the tax system, about half of that is individual income tax. So it's a huge chunk of the tax revenue for the state. The fraud is a big problem. We've already talked about the fraud. That's something we very much worry about on the income tax side. People making up W-2 information or trying to steal. Tax credits is it's an administrative burden. Say what you like about tax credits, whether a good policy or bad policy. Administratively, they're kind of a pain to administer because they create all these one-off kind of returns that often somebody has to look at. So, you know, and again, in my conveyor belt analogy, if your return doesn't have any credits on it or very few deductions, it's kind of easy to process that return.
If it does, it knocks it off the conveyor belt.
Right, but some of these credits, so an example, you can get a credit in Georgia if you buy a low emissions vehicle, but to properly qualify for the credit, you have to go to another state agency. I think it's DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, fill out some paperwork, and they approve you. So they say, yes, you're entitled to it. So when your return comes through the Department of Revenue, we have to look at your return and say, all right, now did they properly get that credit or the approval for the credit from this other agency? So we have to go to that agency, get the information, and then check it. That sounds easy, but practically it takes another step, requires some manual work. And while we could just approve all those returns that come through with a credit on it, it turns out that all these people, I don't know if they're cheating or they just don't know, are improperly taking credit. So in every type of credit that's out there, we reject a huge number of them every year because they're not entitled to them. They didn't get the right approval.
Paperwork.
That's right. And so administratively, it adds another layer. All that is mostly manual kind of work, and it slows stuff down. Doesn't mean people shouldn't take advantage of them. It doesn't mean it's not good policy, but just administratively, they often result in, you know, a little bit slower refund for somebody who's looking for it.
Even if they have all the paperwork.
Even if they have all the paperwork, because someone still has to check it. You know, the computer can't do all the checking in all these. Now, we've tried to automate it, and so where we let we download the information to somebody's file so that the computer can check it on its own, but that's not possible for all of them today.
Right.
That's always been a big area with our returns, the credits, and this goes back before the commissioner's time too. It was at one point in time out of state credits, and now it's these other credits that we're talking about. And it sounds like, at least from what you're saying in our discussions, that. And I think this is good. The way you verify these credits is really through the third party, because most of our returns are e-filed, and we don't attach the Department of Natural Resource certificate or that Georgia scholarship thing. And I have
That's the problem, Joel, right there. The one. We caught you.
That is the problem. We have it. We certainly have it. But I guess you're primarily relying on the third party. And we end up straightening all this thing out. The out-of-state credit issue has gone away. I mean, we had that for many years.
Right.
And I don't know how you verify that.
That was the only credit there was many years.
Yeah,
up until
right.
about 1999, we didn't have all these other things to deal with.
That explains that. I can't remember.
I go back before 1999. You'd already established
somehow that. I don't know how you check that. I don't know whether you're tied into the other states, but somehow those go smoothly. The scholarship one has gotten better. I know the emission thing is whatever, it's working its way around. But I think that's a good way of dealing with it, because we're not providing paper, and that was actually an instruction from the processing head at one time, I remember, to us. You know, hold on to the paper, have it, and we'll deal with it from our end.
Right. So, you know, again, as much as we can do things electronically, the better. As much as we can grab information from another agency, you know, download it into our system and allow that match to happen electronically. I mean, that's how the world works. Everybody out there in the business world is trying to do it. And, you know, our concern is just make sure it's accurate and we can do it in a timely way. You know, again, we don't want to open up the floodgates for people to be claiming credits that they're not entitled to. Not because we don't like them, but it's not our money. It's the taxpayers' money that we'd be giving out.
With respect to future credits, future ideas for credits, then how would you recommend that they be addressed and review that with the Department of Revenue and processing and administrative issues before they're legislated?
Yeah, and in fact, I think we have a pretty good relationship with the legislature now where they do, they don't ask us for our policy recommendations. That's what they get hired to do, is set policy. But we do work with them to try and make sure that the policy they're trying to achieve is easily administrated so that it doesn't create headaches for everybody. And we've, I think, successfully been able to do that as much as we can. Now, there's limits to how that works, but that's the place to do it, is before the legislation is passed, so that we can say, all right, well, we know what you're trying to do. This would be a lot easier way to achieve that same policy and still keep the gear, you know, the gears moving at the department.
That's a pretty big burden they put on you to give you a budget or cut your budget. Has your budget been cut in the last couple of years?
You know, our budget's been relatively stable. It's come down some, right? Every budget in the state has come down over the last several years. But, you know, my view is, you know, we will do as much as we can, as efficiently as we can, with the money that's provided to us. That's our job. It means it's not a perfect world. There is no chance that we collect every nickel of tax revenue due in the state. But to do that, you would need a revenue agent at every corner sitting there for, you know, sure, for every cash transaction, and nobody wants that. So we do the best and most efficient that we can with the money that is provided us. And then it's really a question for the policymakers to decide how big they want the Department of Revenue, how much leakage they're comfortable with. And so, you know, whether it's the right amount or not, I don't know, but it's, you know, it's a lot of money, and our goal and our job is to spend it as efficiently as possible.
It takes a lot of time for you to adjust to something like the TAVT. I don't know what that took in manpower, but
it does, and that's why Michael Long shouldn't have been playing any golf.
Sorry about that,
Michael. I don't know what he was talking about.
Yeah,
maybe he'd seen it on YouTube or something.
You know, talking about the credits, let me ask you a quick question. Because you had mentioned something to me, or I heard you mention something. When I talk to credits about when I talk to clients about credits, and we've done another show on credits, which was one of our higher rated shows. But if you remember,
they're sensitive about credit.
They really are, aren't they?
Yeah, that was one of our best. the first thing that comes up, one of the first is film credits. Because you buy whatever it is, 90 cents at a dollar, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Are those a slam dunk?
We review every credit that goes through. It depends on what you mean by slam dunk. There are perfectly legitimate, acceptable credit here in Georgia. It's a legislative policy that, and without going into all the details, but it, you know, if you shoot a film here in Georgia, you're allowed to sell those credits off. What the market price is the market price, but if somebody buys them and they're legitimate film tax credits, they're an absolutely appropriate deduction. Now, we will look at it and make sure that they're legitimate film tax credits, and we've denied some in the past because the people didn't do what they said they did. They didn't really shoot a film. They sold something that they weren't entitled to sell. But the vast majority of film credits that have come through, we've approved because they're legitimate. There is a mechanism for some of them to get, in effect, pre-approved by the department. They can get audited before they're sold, in which case there's really no uncertainty at all about how they'll be treated by us. But the vast, vast majority go through, not a problem. Sometimes they take a little bit of time just to make sure that we've collected the information we need, but they're absolutely legitimate form of tax planning, I guess, or use of a tax credit.
All right, because at one, somebody, either you or someone else, had mentioned, I was concerned, and you've answered my question, that there was a large one that was being disallowed, and I didn't know, and I guess then it would reach out to, obviously, everyone who...
Who touched it, yeah. In that place, they didn't do what they had to do to qualify for it, and that happens.
That happens, yeah.
But it's the public policy it has achieved the public policy I think the legislators wanted, which is the film business is now a big business it here is. In Georgia.
Right.
Hundreds of millions of dollars of movies are shot every year now, you know, everything from big stuff to small stuff. And it's become a big business, which is what they wanted. And this is the part of the way that they have helped fund it.
You know, and sort of as a follow-up to what John was asking, do you, I guess you have some knowledge as to the Department of Revenues in other states. How do we rank, how do we compare in terms of budget, number of personnel? I know some states do extensive examinations in, and these are the bigger states, in other locations. They do residency audits. They have bigger staffs. But in terms of, I guess, states comparable population-wise, size-wise, do you have any idea?
Yeah, it's Georgia, I think, prides itself on being a relatively tax-friendly state. So some of the activities that other states are engaged in, Georgia just won't ever be engaged in because we're not trying to get every last nickel from every taxpayer out there. We just tax less than a lot of states, so there's less things to look at, especially on the corporate side, where you know we're pretty easy and pretty straightforward. If you're a corporation, what you have to do and what you don't have to worry about. But I think generally the size of the departments and their budgets, their number of personnel, tie to the size of the state. So Georgia's now the ninth largest state in the country. We're probably not the ninth largest Department of Revenue, but we're almost certainly within the top 15 in terms of size and budget and all of those things. Now, every department is a little different, right? I talked earlier about alcohol and tobacco and motor vehicle. There are some states that have similar operations in theirs. There are some states that don't have the motor vehicle. There are some states that don't have the alcohol and tobacco. And so you got to take that into account as well. But we get together every year with some of the other administrators. There's not a lot of people who do what we do out there, 50 other states or 49 other states, and talk about what's going on. And there's also a Southeast Association that does the same sort of thing, since there's probably more similarity among the Southeast states than, say, with New York or California in what we do.
Okay.
I have a couple of questions. I don't know, how much time do we have left here?
Till you get boring.
Till we get boring. We'd have been gone a long time ago, I guess.
Yeah, boy.
No, I stopped broadcasting a half hour ago.
Oh.
I just thought we were visiting.
Well, I had one question here. I noticed that there's a backlog of unapplied payments. And so my question for the general information is, what happens to those payments if they don't get applied, or what's the time frame for having them applied in Georgia?
So an unapplied payment is, to give you a typical fact pattern, somebody sends in a check with a form, and the check somehow gets separated from the form in transit. So we get the check, but there's no form attached to it, or the form doesn't have information on it. They forgot to put their name or social security number or what it was for. So one thing we're really good at is cashing the check. We will. Dang good at cashing the check. So we will cash that check. But then it sort of sits in suspense because we don't know, or the form is the right name, social, but it doesn't have the right period. So if you're a business, you're filing every month or every quarter, but we don't know where to apply it to, and hence the unapplied payment. So the money sits in suspense, and this is a root cause of a lot of problems for the department, for the taxpayer, because you can see what's going to happen, right? The check's deposited, but it's not applied. So our system will say, hey, you owed us money. We don't have the money. We're going to send a letter to you. So we crank out a letter automatically. It goes to the taxpayer. The taxpayer gives it to their CPA. The CPA writes us a letter, calls us. So now you've created three work items out of one misapplied payment. Well, if we don't answer that first letter, first phone call, we're going to get another phone call, another letter, blah, blah, blah. It goes on and on. It just creates work. So historically, we had done very little with unapplied payments. We'd sort of said, that's taxpayers' burden. They'll call us eventually, and we'll eventually get around to it. But we've now started putting people up front to take that pile of unapplied payments and start looking, because we're going to have to do the same work whether we do it up front or after we get three phone calls and three letters. You know, somebody has to look at the check and say, all right, well, this is a taxpayer. I'm going to call the taxpayer and say, what period were you trying to put this in for, or why did you send us this check? That could be literally a 30-second conversation. Take that applied payment, put it in the right place, boom, we're done. We saved ourselves postage on the letter, a phone call, all those sorts of things. So we now have people who try to do it up front. But as you can see by looking at the numbers, which the listeners don't have in front of them, there's a constant stream of incoming ones of those unapplied payments. So it's never going to go away. And if we stop working on that pile, it's going to start building up again. And there's a lot, you know, sometimes it's our fault. Sometimes it's the taxpayer's fault. Sometimes it's nobody's fault. It just, you know, it happens that way. So it's a big thing that we've looked at in why that number has come down, but why it will never be zero.
Well, that's good though. I'm real glad to see that. It's the cost of doing business. Errors are going to be made no matter what the rules are. So you have to address it, and I'm glad to see that you are addressing it. And the last question that I had was what about 2014? What's your administrative headaches that you're looking forward to in the remainder of 2000? Well, it's 2014. I'm living in the past. 2015.
Well, every year around this time, we start gearing up for tax filing season. So, again, big data processor. We have to have our systems in place and ready to go kind of by January 1. Another reason Mike Long should not be playing golf right now. And, you know, we have to take into account any changes in the law. Once we have our system set to run on early January, they got to run that way for all the taxpayers, right? We don't want to be messing around, changing rules or changing how we're processing. So, you know, a lot of work goes into now, and then we test that system to make sure it works. Because when we flip it on, as you know, people start filing tax returns day one, and it doesn't stop. And at the end of the day, we've had over 4 million, or right around 4 million returns that get filed with us, and 3 million refunds that go out the door. So, once it starts, it's a huge volume. It's got to be set up to handle that volume. Right. So that always is something that we're worried about, making sure that our systems are robust. They're going to, take that volume and be able to process it. And then it's the same thing the next year, and the next year, and the next year after that. That's probably the thing that when you say worry about. I'm not worried that it won't work, but we need to make sure the right people are doing the right thing and getting the system in the right shape.
Curious. I don't think I've ever asked this before, but when the legislature is late passing the conformity bill, which, you know, is the way the system works, it's inevitable. What kind of problem does that actually give you from an administrative perspective in terms of follow-on returns or amended returns to correct things that you didn't know about in the beginning? Is that much of a problem for you?
Well, it certainly adds, you know, some work to the department. I wouldn't say it's, and I don't think anybody's like crying themselves to sleep at night, you know, over it. But, it, you know, there certainly adds some burden, you know, to everybody, to the taxpayers, to the department, because people do have to go back and clean up, or they might have to go back and clean up. And that's not ideal. In the ideal world, they'd pass any tax law changes early in the session so that they could be accommodated, but you know, life's not perfect. So,
no, I've often wondered that same question. I got one last question for you, and it's just your personal opinion, really. Where do you see this in terms of, I guess, tax, the source of tax revenues? You hear about all these movements to eliminate income taxes, state income taxes. You know, simplify, make them more elementary, and the thinking is, you know, that at some point, maybe not during your tenure, will happen or could happen, and then maybe sales tax base rates would go up. Where do you, just based on what you're reading and your experience, where do you see this going? Do you see that coming about at some point in the future?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know. I can give you a few facts that I think help inform the discussion. So personally, I don't know. You know, personally, I don't think it'd be a horrible idea to be more consumption-based. If you look at the numbers, but I guess let me see the but on that. But nobody downtown, nobody in the legislature cares what my opinion is about tax policy. My job is to administer whatever they pass, just to be clear. If you look at the numbers, you know, the state collects $18, $19 billion a year in tax revenue every year. We talked about that. Half of that is individual income tax. So most of the discussion you hear is get rid of the individual income tax, replace it with more of a consumption, sales tax. If you want to keep it revenue neutral, you're going to have to find $8.5 billion of additional consumption or sales tax. Sales tax is about 30% of state revenue today. Individual income tax is half. And so it's math. So there's only two ways to do that with a consumption tax. You either have to tax more things, or you have to raise the tax rate, or some combination of both. And that would mean a lot more people would have to pay a lot more. Vendors would have to pay sales tax, or collect sales tax, not pay it. service providers, probably, because service is a big part of our economy,
yeah,
as everybody
right.
knows.
That too, yeah.
Or you're going to have to increase the marginal tax rate pretty significantly. The tax rate now at the state level is 4%, and that generates 30% of the state revenue. If you want to find 50% of state revenue, the math is if you don't change what you're taxing, you'd have to more than double that rate just to make it tax neutral. Now, I think there's some belief that you would pick up some transactions that are not taxed now, parts of the economy that aren't taxed, so maybe that rate doesn't have to go as high. But it's there'd be a lot of work to do either in training people to collect sales tax, service providers, or in changing that rate.
Okay.
So in your budget where you've got the amount for sales tax, that's just the 4% Georgia sales tax that you're counting
there,
right. Not the local option and SPLOST
that's
and
right.
so forth.
Okay. We collect all sales tax here right. in the state. The department sends 4% over to the state treasury, and the other, depending on where you live, 3%, 4% if you live in the city of Atlanta, we collect that for the counties, and then every month we send a check to each
right.
county, in effect, for their part of the sales tax. So we work with counties across the state, obviously on a daily basis.
And so the budget, for my own clarity, was it did not include the only the sales tax for the state of Georgia.
4%. That's correct. 4%.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, Stone, how are we doing?
You're doing a fantastic job, gentlemen. Yeah. Thank you so much for coordinating this segment, Doug, Commissioner. Thank you so much for coming. This really has been informative. I got to tell you, you're doing a great job, man.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate y'all having me, and look forward to continuing to work with y'all at the Georgia Society and try to make life as easy for taxpayers here in the state as possible.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right. Until next time, this is Stone Payton for our host today, Joel Pascanner and John Masters, our guest, Doug McGinnity, Commissioner with the Georgia Department of Revenue, and everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you next time on Atlanta Business Radio.